Back in 2014, I met today's guests as we were both working on a workshop of a new musical based on the hit movie First Wives Club. We both continued on with the show as it traveled to Chicago for its out-of-town pre-Broadway tryout. However, the musical never made it to New York. But as you'll hear in my conversation today with Teron Brooks, the journey of most performers is never a straight line, and certainly there are many more failures and disappointments than successes. And Teron certainly knows something about success. As a two-time NAACP Award nominee and widely recognized for his critically acclaimed role as the great Eddie Kendricks in the Emmy Award-winning NBC series The Temptations, which is in addition to his Broadway performances and countless concerts around the country. You see, through music, acting, writing, and even speaking, Teron has constantly defied labels and broken through boundaries, all while encouraging everyone to reach their highest potential. And today, Teron has brought us three stories showing how he has certainly had to learn this lesson himself the hard way. One, by managing his own expectations of success and fame. Second, by confronting the possible loss of his voice and what that would mean for his career. And finally, learning to face his own pains and disappointments in order to be a better father and husband. Through it all, Teron shows us that despite the bumpy roads we may travel in our life or career, the greatest journey we can take is in discovering our unique and authentic self and using our gifts to serve others.
My name is Teron Brooks. I am from Long Beach, California. I currently live in Los Angeles, California, and I'm an entertainer. I guess that's what I call myself as the job. I feel like a Jamaican. I have 80 jobs, but entertainer is what I would say.
Welcome, and thank you for joining me for another episode of Why I'll Never Make It, a Top 25 Theater Podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, an actor and singer, talking with fellow creatives each and every week as they bring us three stories from their own life of personal struggles and professional hardships with lessons we can all learn from. The website is whyillnevermakeit.com, where you can sign up for the Win Me newsletter and learn more about useful artist resources. Again, that's whyillnevermakeit.com. Well, welcome, Teron. It is so great to not only reconnect with you again, but to have you here on my podcast and get a chance to talk to you. Thank you so much for being here.
Patrick, I'm honored because I know you have an illustrious array of people. I've seen that you've had a lot of people on your show, and just to really talk to you again, we really had a connection all those years, and I'm really glad to kind of rekindle that today if we can a little bit.
Yeah, because you and I have been in the business around the same time. You know, we've had a few decades together as far as working in business. You there on the West Coast, me on the East Coast. And I remember in the dressing room, we would, we'd listen to the kids as they're talking about their little things. And then we'd talk more about the real life things in the dressing room.
Yeah, I think it was fun to be able to be in a position to see where we were, where we thought we were going. We thought we were going to Broadway, but, just to connect on that way with you. And there was such a humbleness to your character. And that's usually the people that I try to latch on to that don't take the job so seriously, right? Love what we're doing, but also know who they are as individuals and what they bring to the table, aside from just being a performer. So you just had that, and we just connected on that human level, I think, as well.
Exactly. Yeah. I tend to be the same. I mean, I love a talented performer as much as anyone, but I like people who have a bit more to them than just this business, than just sing, acting, and that's all they can talk about or think about. So yeah, I'm glad we connected on several different levels, not just our performing side. Well, I wanted to start off with the first story that you wanted to discuss, and that was whenever you were 23. You were cast as Eddie Kendricks in the Emmy Award-winning miniseries The Temptations. And now this was very early on in your career. It was at a point where you really had no resume. Still, at the same time, you just assumed, hey, I'll be famous after this show, right? I'm going to make it. I've done it. But that status and level of fame you envisioned for yourself hasn't quite come to fruition yet. That type of fame, you know, may never come to you. So why did you think that this one show would launch you into stardom, and why was it that important to you?
Well, I think when you're young, you're hoping to get to that level of success. You're not sure that it's going to happen so soon. So there's a process when you're young that you're thinking, I have to work hard to get to that level. You have to understand, for me, I had done a couple of TV shows. I'd done some theater shows. I was on the trajectory of doing something with my life. But going to that audition, NBC, with actors, I won't say their names, that we all know in the room, you're just, you know, it was pretty impossible to think that I was going to get that position, to be one of the Temptations in this big miniseries that went on to win Emmys, and 45 million people saw it. I was on buses. I was on magazine covers. I had limos picking me up at the door. It went from nothing to this life where, when you're young, I'm thinking, well, after this, we'll steamroll along. And even now, when I look at my peers in that group, I see a lot of the actors who have gone on to do some amazing things, you know? So I could say to myself, well, shouldn't I have been one of those people? Because I was in that same movie. Shouldn't that have happened for me? And I did define it for many years, because even today, I still get recognized for that role. So I'm moving on with my life, not even thinking when I wake up in the morning, oh, I was in this miniseries years ago. And I can go anywhere by any kind of person, any race or ethnicity, or person would say, hey, Eddie, or know or recognize me and really have a fondness to this piece of work, because it was a real person, you know, Eddie Kendrick. So I think for me, it was maybe a little bit of a delusion that, you know, I think it's natural to think that maybe you would think that if we were doing this, that equals this. People saw me all over the world. Hey, where are the other roles? But I know now differently. I know now the real reasons, and I found more peace in adjusting to the way that things are than in those times. It was really difficult.
Well, I'm certainly guessing that you enjoyed working on that miniseries. I mean, as you said, you had done a couple of theater things, but now you're in a whole different level of performance and with people and expectations of what you need to be. So what were some of the moments or events that really stood out to you from being in that miniseries?
Well, I think part of being naive was helpful. Part of not knowing was helpful, because I didn't really know it until now, or years later, the impact that it would make on everybody, right? Of course, I was a fan of the Temptations. Of course, I knew they were a big group, but I didn't know number-wise what the show would do. I didn't know about Emmys or anything like that. So I think there was a sense of fun, and we worked really, really, really hard as a cast, as a group, to make something, you know, meaningful for people. And I think those days where we were the Temptations, like the days where we performed in front of other people in the custom clothes, in that moment, I was Eddie Kendricks, right? In that moment, and the way that they recreated it, it was like, wow, this is everything I want, Teron wants in his life. And I get to act it out, if that makes sense, every day, you know? And then here are the stories from Smokey Robinson and, you know, Otis Williams himself, who was an original member of the Temptations. So being a part of that history was just, and acting with some of the best actors of our generation in that film, you know, was just really, really amazing.
Because now you're in a room with these legends of music and of performance. So of course, you're now thinking, I'm now in the room with these. I can achieve this. I can rise up to this level. And maybe this is the beginning of something for me. I assume that then, of course, is what you're thinking about.
Absolutely. If I'm thinking, if I can't do it here with all of these opportunities and all of these people, what other thing would you need? Right? I mean, it may be being naive or just thinking, hey, this is the moment. I'm with all these people. What can happen, you know? But a lot can happen with your intentions, right? Every single person has an intention for their life. And so we tend to look at people and say, well, one, two, three, and there's success. There's decisions along the way that also go into that success or those choices. And I'd have to be honest to say that I have made many, many choices, not contrary to success, but maybe pro-family or pro-faith or pro, you know, other things that I can't just blame, oh, it just didn't happen because maybe I wasn't completely willing to go down every road that was open to me. So I'm mature enough to see that now, that those decisions were into play.
Yeah.
You know,
but certainly at the time it was difficult to see what exactly that path forward was going to be. So what did that look like? What did that feel like once the miniseries ended, as you began to have these expectations for what was coming next?
Well, I feel it was like disappointment after disappointment because, see, I was, you know, you find these situations where you hear the adage that it was meant for you, like a certain thing that you did was just meant for you. The Temptations was, and I can say it now, and just the whole way that it went down, that was a job that was meant for me. Like I was born to play Eddie Kendricks. It doesn't mean that I was born to be a movie star, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, so it took me a long time to understand, oh, no, that was true. That was a moment for you. You were the one to play it, to do it, but it didn't mean that it needed to equal the dedication to the craft of acting that I did not have, whatever the other things that maybe everyone else I thought was doing, I may have not been doing. You know, and I had to take ownership of what I really wanted to do in my life, the intentions that I have, my career goals. Never before that movie, it never was to be a movie star. So why all of a sudden, because I got one thing, my psyche changed and I'm ready to be a movie star? And not that I wasn't working hard, but it just, I'll say it's the heart. My heart wasn't really in that. And so what I'm doing today is everything I intend to do, everything I want to do, no matter what the success level is. I've gone on the path and I have no regrets, or I don't feel unhappy. I don't feel unfulfilled. Those are the things that I would love to do. But I think as a young man, I let other people's expectations and what it looked like override the work, the dedication, the persistence, and the purpose. It just seemed like, oh, well, this is what's destined to me. And it didn't turn out that way.
Now, with that effort, did you feel a sense of, well, if I put in the effort, I should get the result? Was there that kind of expectation?
I think it was that, but I also just think it was, you know, mirror it to today with followers. You know, when I did The Temptations, there was no social media. There was no, you know, so I thought in my mind, that's social media. That's the following. 45 million people saw me. They want me. I was in people's faces. I was in people's homes. So I should be able to take these meetings and do whatever I need to do. That didn't mean that the dude that showed up to the meetings was ready, was right, was, you know, prepared, had the right fire. You know, it was a delusional situation a little bit on my part. And I want to be candid with you, Patrick, because I know I can. I think there was a little bit of a race thing because it was an African-American. The Temptations were five black men. And I'm not sure if we played the Beatles, if I was Ringo in the Beatles miniseries, maybe at the time, we have to talk about the time, 1998, what was really available was also, I didn't take that into account. I'm just thinking, oh, I'm going to bust through the doors. There still wasn't a lot of roles for people that look like me. You know what I mean? Maybe they were the thug roles or the gangster roles or the stereotypical roles that I did not want to play. But there wasn't like a huge host of like it is today. Right. So I think a lot of things came into the play, and most of it was just me being young, you know? And having to really take responsibility. See, the easy thing for us to do as performers is to blame everyone else.
Yep. Oh, yes. That's very easy. Yeah.
For why we're not making it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because in that time in the 90s, it was Denzel Washington, Morgan Freeman. And if you wanted a black actor, you probably hired one of those two.
Sure.
There wasn't as many diverse options as I think studios and theaters are trying to do now.
Yeah.
And also, I think being musical, then people are going to see you, oh, well, this isn't a singing role, so we're not going to hire you for that. Did that ever come into play too?
I think so. But I think truly my gift is the musical gift. the acting gift was something that I had to work on. And perhaps I had natural abilities. But see, you would think that after that movie, I would go into acting class heavily to be better at that. No, I just thought, hey, you know, you saw me on the show. I'm great, you know. So there was a little bit of that, but I did work on my music, right? I worked on my writing. I worked on other things that I had passion for, but I did not work on this dream of being a movie star as much as I, and I don't regret it. I know why, because that wasn't really my purpose. I just made something that looked pretty, obviously, and being impressionable to other people. I would get it all the time. You know, what are you doing now? Why aren't you doing, you know, you should be this and you should be that. So then I go, oh yeah, you just buy into the whole thing until you find your own voice and make your own choices.
Yeah, yeah, because there are the expectations that others place on us as well as ourselves. And it can really be a balancing act as far as which one to listen to at a given moment.
Yeah, yeah. I think for many years, I believed the hype. I just believed the hype. And it was easier to do that because then I didn't have to really do the work. If I could just blame the hype, believe the hype, sit into disappointment all the years or whatever. And let me say this, it wasn't that I didn't work after. I did a lot of great things. I still had a career, and that miniseries today still propels a lot of my success because people still remember that. Thank God it was something that valuable or successful or meaningful to people. So I'm not going to lose that ever. I'm not sitting here disgruntled about the other things that it did lead to, but the trajectory wasn't hit the moon the next moment, you know.
You had mentioned about training, and I think that that's something that I know that I've struggled with as well, is like, I feel like that I've achieved a certain level or I've been cast in these honor roles, so I know how to do that. There was certainly a time where I was more focused on going to the next audition rather than training and preparing for that next audition. And so I was constantly about getting the work and not doing the work, if that makes sense. And so how have you found that training either helps or when to know that you need the training?
Yeah, that's difficult when you feel like you might have a gift to do something. A lot of us are gifted to do things and are very, very successful with minimal amount of training. You know what I mean? Some training, but maybe not a lot of training. And when you see success, obviously, when I got the Temptations movie, did I train to get that? Not one minute. Now, my musical theater background, my singing skills and everything, my performance skills, I'm sure that went into them going, hey, and I will go back and say, we got the parts, but we didn't have to sing. You could get it as an actor, and then we had an audition to sing. And I was fortunate to be able to sing like 90% of Eddie Kendrick's. So that was two separate things. So I'm very proud that the singing, if it wasn't there, I still would have gotten the role. But to answer your question, yeah, I just think for me now, I know if I really want something, right? And I really want to walk away with no regrets on how it turns out. Because how it turns out, just because I get it or don't get it, it's still on me for what I put into it. And if I can walk away going, I put everything into this and it still wasn't working for me, that's when I can get to a level of peace. If I go, gosh, I did not do everything I could, everything that was possible, there's really no real reason for me to be disgruntled or angry with the other person, the other actor that got it or whatever, you know, because I can say that. So I think for me, it's just counting up the cost. This is something I want. Am I passionate about it? Am I giving 100% to this thing, right? For me, singing, and I've taken voice lessons even in recent years because I felt like Kobe Bryant or any athlete, I lacked in understanding, hey, I'm getting older. I'm singing the same way that I used to, but I have to train this voice. Mm-hmm. And if I'm going to go out there and be on Broadway or do a stellar performance, I have to put the energy into these chords, these muscles, the way that it is now, how to weather these storms. And so recently I've been able to train so I can have that longevity, but it's definitely passion and purpose. If you really want something and you're seeing that you're not succeeding, Patrick, that's what I'm saying. Maybe, could it be the training? I'm not saying it is that. I'm just saying it could be a multiple of reasons, but check off the things that it could be so you can get to a place where you can give your best if that's what you love to do. I love to act. I love to perform. But in recent years, I've had to just say, what am I really called to do? You know, and what do I even love to do? But I'm not, that's not my purpose. See, those are two different things for me.
Yeah. And I think that this pandemic has certainly brought that to the forefront for myself. And I think a lot of performers and artists in the fact that, okay, well, if this part of my performing or opportunity is gone, then what am I? What can I do? What am I passionate about? What can take its place and still fulfill me? And I think that that's a journey that I've been on kind of even before COVID, but it really kicked it into overdrive once the pandemic started, and that I need to find something that brings me this sense of fulfillment, this sense of peace, but also happiness and enjoyment. And I'm kind of still on that journey. Have you found yourself on that journey, or it kind of wanes, comes and goes?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the pandemic really showed me actually what I would do in an obstacle, in a time where I couldn't do the thing that everyone knows me for. It really showed up positively for me that I still, actually, I love what we're doing right now. One of the things that I love about my career is being a motivational speaker, or being able to talk, or being able to write, or being able to encourage people on a level like we're doing right now that has nothing. I'm not even singing right now, right? I'm not performing right now. So that COVID couldn't take that away from me, and I still found myself in that. So I agree with you. I think we're still doing that on some level. And I think we're going to come out stronger when things open up again completely and we go back. Hopefully we're going back with a sense of power and ownership, not a sense of, you know, if the skies fall, we can't do anything, right? You know, like taking the control back, because we've had these moments to reflect on who we are. And knowing that if this is taken away, or this is taken away, or that opportunity is taken away, what is left standing, you know? And I'm constantly trying to figure that out, especially I have a family and I still have to provide in ways. I want to wake up in the morning and do work that I love, but I've created a lane for myself where it doesn't have to be that one thing.
Now, we're years away from 98 and the Temptations, and you've had, 20 years more of performing and learning and growing. So what are the expectations now that you hold for yourself at this point in your career?
Well, Patrick, I think it's a shift. It's a new year, and a lot of people are asking about resolutions and what we want to do for the new year. And, you know, I can only laugh at that, especially because of what's going on right now, that everything I can intend to do, hope so, you know, yeah. You know. So it's like, I've decided not to focus on the things and to really focus on who I want to be, What are those personal goals in my relationships, you know, my wife, my marriage, my kids, my family? Who I want to be feels to me might be the key to opening the bigger doors of what I do. Because the thing is, we chase what we do, we chase these opportunities. And when we walk through the opportunities, sometimes we're not ready. Sometimes the person that walks through those things and gets those things, you're not ready, you know? And I don't want to fumble success. I think I'm going to focus on, you know, personal growth, right? And I can still have my goals and things that I want to do. But if I focus on personal growth, I believe that those doors, when they open, I'll be ready to walk in them and have richer experiences by doing that. So I'm less focused on the doing, what I'm going to do. And I'm just in the moment of who am I, like we said earlier, and finding the success in that. So whoever hires me or whatever will get the best me when they see me.
Yeah. And that best you changes. As you said, from year to year, from job to job, as you grow as a person, as a performer, it's something that my husband and I, we were kind of just talking about the relationship and you know, as you said, being a new year, kind of what the new year brings for us. And we started talking about how we've changed even from when we got married, that was 3 years ago, till now, and we will continue to change. And it's the same as a performer. Who I was 5, 10, 15 years ago, I could do that role, but now I could do a different role, or I would do that role differently now. And I think we're constantly changing, and we have to allow ourselves to go through those changes and it not be a bad thing, not be a, oh, I've lost a step, or I can't do that anymore, or oh, I wish I could play that, you know, 20-year-old role again. You know, no, it's like we are now a different place, a different person, and we need to embrace that and let that best version of ourselves come out.
Absolutely. I played Ragtime. I played Cole House 2 times over maybe a 5 or 6 year period. And it was completely different, you know, the first time and the second time with who I was as a man, what was going on with society. The second time I played Ragtime, with how I was dealing with my family, my own children, I was able to connect in a different way. So you're absolutely right about that. And I think that's the journey. Even you're different tomorrow. The person, Patrick, who you are today, tomorrow you'll be another, a different person or a better person. Or if you so quote you slip, I think that's the ebb and flow that I wish people will accept. How life rolls like that. Accept the fact that it's just never a mountaintop experience, and then another mountaintop, and it's hills and valleys, and it's learning to love yourself through it all, you know. And I've learned through those valleys probably more lessons through the valleys than any mountaintop experience has ever shown me, you know. And that's, as actors and performers, what we're bringing to the table, to connect to all these roles that we're doing. If we are not having any of these valley moments or myriad of experiences, what the heck are we doing when we're trying to connect to people that feel different things, because we have never felt them.
Well, certainly one of the valleys that you experienced was back in 2014, and that was when you lost your voice. As you said, you're a singer. That's what you are first and foremost, but you lost your voice due to a polyp that was on your vocal cords, and the doctor suggested surgery, but you refused that surgery. So I'm curious what went into your thought process, because last season I spoke to Rodney Hicks. He was on the podcast and he talked about losing his voice during Come From Away. So what exactly was going on with your throat, and then how did it affect your ability to speak and sing?
Well, I'll try to go back. It was maybe about almost 2 months of struggle, you know, because you never know. You don't always go to the doctor first thing when things go on like we should. You kind of wait out what's going on. Can I sing through this? What is this? And then it was getting to the period of time where I was losing a lot of my falsetto and a lot of the things that, like, what my voice does naturally, I couldn't do. It was kind of weighed down, never hurt or anything like that. And I was talking to my friend, Stephanie Block, and we were having lunch, and she was like, "You need to go to the doctor." And I was like, "What?" Because I think she had some personal things that, you know, other people can see things that you may not be able to see. And she was like, "You need to go to the doctor." And I was like, "Okay." And literally went and found out that there was a polyp. And it was interesting. And I'm not going to throw any doctor under the bus, but I went to one of the top doctors here in Los Angeles, and they were making it like it was my choice. You know, literally, here's surgery, here's the option, or you could not have surgery, sing like you're doing that for the longest time. And, you know, and I felt really trapped, because I was like, wow, I'm coming to a doctor to get it, like, advice. Mm-hmm. And that taught me a lot, Patrick, about how we go to people for advice, or we go to people and we really want them to tell us what to do. You know, I'm kind of wired like that. Tell me what to do. Tell me how to paint, and I will be perfect if you tell me the steps, you know. And I've learned in life that there's intuition. There's a gut, right? There's something inside of me that helps me make decisions as well. Even if I get good advice, that I still have to lean on. And so the doctor literally said, you know, she told me the risks of the surgery, and she told me the risks of not having it. And I just went away, and I had a gut feeling. And it doesn't really make sense, because my world is singing. That's how I make money. You know, I should have just said, let's do the surgery right away and I'll be fine, you know? But there was, thank God, a time for me to, it took 3 months for my voice to come back, but a time for me to reflect and to really feel like, what is this? And I'll be honest, I'm a man of faith. So I pray for other people. I believe in the power of healing and, you know, what God can do, but I prayed for myself. And I just believed, like I just said, oh, I'm going to be okay. I'm not going to have the surgery, and I'm going to be okay. You know? And, you know, I ended up being okay, but I was surprised that my worth connected to performing and singing and having the voice that I had. I was surprised that I actually made a little deal with God. I said, I'm either going to sing like Kermit the Frog with this voice that I have that's horrible sounding to me, and I'm going to be more effective in this world with this crazy voice because you gave it to me and that's the way you want it, or I'm going to be healed and I'm going to be better than I was before. And I kind of surrendered the weight of who I was and the walking microphone. And I tell you, it was the most beautiful thing to understand that I felt like I would be okay even if I didn't sing again.
When you lost your voice, or as you were having these vocal problems, did it impact the way that you thought about yourself, your own self-worth as a singer?
In the beginning stage, it was defining, but I never thought about worth. I thought about providing for my family. Like, I thought about, what am I going to do? I thought about, oh my gosh, because that's what I do to make money. I want to say I did not think about worth, which surprised me. I'm just being honest. It didn't show up in the way that I thought. You think if you lose something, or Patrick, if I told you tomorrow you're going to lose all, you know what I mean? You would write out how you would feel, what you would do. And it's perfectly, you know, human to have this conversation and say, you don't really know what you're going to do when something happens like that. And I was surprised and shocked that, no, I did go to a fear place of, man, I didn't marry this woman. I got these kids. And what are we going to do? You know, like, I was in that space of fear, but never in a place that I could not be valuable to the world or whatever my purpose was. I actually got excited a little bit. Not to lose my voice and never sing again, but I was like, because I believe that everything happens for a reason. And I believe that the gift that I had was given to me anyway. So I'm like, wow, if this gift is taken away from me or I can't use it, I just believe that there was something going to be replaced, something better, something different. And I was open and ready for that thing. And I just believed, and I don't know how, that I would evolve into something, you know, different, better, or that the valley and the challenge of the moment I would need to see, which I know right now I needed to see who that guy was, you know.
What was it that you did, or treatment that you found? What was it that finally was the turning point that brought your voice back to what it wanted to be?
Well, I was diagnosed in January. I think mid-March, I had this huge gig that I accepted, but I didn't tell the people what they were going to get vocally.
Because how different was it comparatively with what you used to be able to do?
Some people said they didn't notice it, but I knew how I had to maneuver. I knew that it was significant breaks in my voice and range. And, you know, I knew that if someone was going to hire me and didn't know who I was, I could fake it. But if people hire you for what you do,
if they had an expectation.
Yeah, yeah. If they had an expectation that Teron Brooks and he's going to do this, it wasn't going to happen. If it was something else that I could kind of fake and do something different, it was probably okay, you know? But that just wasn't the case. And the jobs, 9 out of 10 jobs I get are not agent refer. It's a referral from another job that I've done, you know? And there is an expectation on a call. We heard about you. We saw your video. Can you come and do it, you know? So this job was from someone who knew me, and I said, sure. And I knew that I had a couple weeks to get myself together. So I ended up making an appointment with my voice coach. And she said, let's start working together and see what we can do, you know? And she said, before you see me, I want you to go gluten-free. And if you know me, I eat everything, and I'm not trying to go gluten-free or...
I love me some bread.
What is that? What? Do what now? You know, how long? You know? I did it. And Patrick, from a Monday starting the gluten-free to the Friday of that week, because I was going to see her on the next Monday, my voice started to come back because of the cutting out of something I think a doctor should say with inflammatory something on your cords. Like, you know, before we do surgery, is there anything else? this is my story. I'm not, you know, an advocating anything to anybody else who's going through things. But by Friday of a week, my voice was back because I went gluten-free. Now, could it be the 3 months of the healing and all the other stuff? It could it be, I think it's God. I think it's a mixture of different things. My point of the story is that me trusting my gut to not have the surgery, thank God, I feel fortunate that I did that. And by doing something natural, you know, my voice went back. Now, the question was, Teron, did you go back and get an X-ray on your voice to see if the polyp was gone? No, I didn't. I believed I was fine. I was singing better by the next week. I was able to do that job successfully. I started to get my voice strong again. I never sang better after that situation. I've never had any problems since then. But recently I did go to the doctor to check, you know what I mean? They always say, check your cords when you're healthy, check your, you know, and there was really not, there was nothing there, but it was a scary situation and a real kind of miraculous thing that happened. But am I back on the gluten? Yes. but I do know that those things inflame the cords. And
so you've had no lingering issues since that polyp?
No.
Good old Teron is back singing. Yeah.
Better.
Yeah. Better. That's really great. That's really great. So as you said, it certainly worked out for you that you didn't get that surgery, that you kind of listened to yourself. You believed, you had faith of what was the possibility, but at the same time, it could have led to you sounding like Kermit. It could have led to you not being able to have the range, to not be able to sing songs that you could roll out of bed singing. So how did you prepare yourself for that possibility?
I prepared myself. I expected the voice maybe to not come back, maybe. But I placed my bets not on the voice coming back. I placed my bets on my future being bright, incredible, with or without it. So I had an expectation of a happy ending. I just didn't say it needed to be my voice coming back, if that makes sense. I just leaned into a hope and a curiosity, and I got excited for the possibilities. I just was like, God, I'm either going to be healed from this, you know, or I'm going to decide to take the surgery in another 6 months. I mean, who knew how it was going to go? I can't even tell you how it would have gone. I just know in those moments, I had a great opportunity of self-reflecting, of seeing who I was, of knowing that I could be resilient. And that if something happens to me in one way, I will be resilient and I will try something else. So it was almost of a measure of a man moment to say, hey, this is happening to me. Am I going to fold? Am I going to move forward? You know what I mean? What do I think of myself? You know, obviously we paid bills for the time that I was, you know, not singing, I guess. And it's shocking to me too. I just had a hope that things would work for the best. And in my life, I'm always searching for that. Not what's easy or convenient or successful in my own eyes, but what's the best. And sometimes we don't know that for ourselves. We can't own that for ourselves. We just go what's easy. We go for what's attainable, what's around, what's expected. I'm on a trajectory of trying to look, you know, I believe there's a reason why I'm here on earth. What's that reason? And if it takes a sharp left or right when I didn't know it, then I can look at it in excitement, not in fear. Like, whoa, this must be good. You know, I must be able to do something else. And hopefully I'll be able to transition. So I think that's the best gift from this whole thing and what the conversation is leading is that getting that gift early. When COVID hit, you couldn't tell me anything. I've already been through something.
Right. And I think that shift in mindset, that shift in the way of perspective was really important for you. And I think it's something that I'm slowly learning even myself in that rather than you focusing on, okay, my voice needs to be better or it needs to do this or it's got to do that. And then you focused on, well, what am I going to do? Okay, if my voice goes back, great. If my voice goes in a different direction, how am I going to adjust? How am I going to prepare for that? So rather than focusing on the other circumstance, you're focusing on, well, how am I going to approach that new circumstance? How am I going to adjust? And I think that's so much more not only powerful, but useful and doable. Because we know what we can do and kind of change within ourselves. It's hard sometimes to change, but it's doable. But what they're going to do, or our voice is going to do, or our bodies, or this job, or what, all those outside things, we just don't know what's going to happen.
Yes, Patrick. Yes. Yes. You said a mouthful. Yes. And fortunately, I had a little bit of a trial or a valley to kind of test that out, because I think we're all feeling like we're losing control. And we kind of, I'm a control freak. So let me be the first one to sign up. I'll be in the first row of the group. You know, I need to know what's going to happen. I need to map it out. I'm a great planner. But, you know, these last few years has taught me, I've leaned on some great peace of saying, hey, I don't know. And just, I'm going to focus on what I do know and what I can change or adjust to. And it's been really powerful and healing for me to feel that no matter if the rug is slipped under me or they don't hire me or whatever, I'll be able to be resilient, you know? And I do believe that there is a thing that we're all meant to do here on earth. And I know there are forces against those things and discouragements and losses along the way. But ultimately, and whether this is Pollyanna or not, I believe that I'll find it. You know, it's like getting lost, but you eventually get there.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, maybe it took an extra day or, you know, some extra minutes or whatever, but you eventually got there. You know, I'm focusing on when I get there. I'm not worried about that. Who is showing up? Is he distressed? Is he angry? Is he bitter? Is he resentful when he gets there from all the things that didn't happen? That's the worst thing that could happen, Patrick, is that you actually get there and you walk through the door and here's the contract and here's the movie and here's the thing, and you are a wreck of a person.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I feel like forget that. Forget, I don't know what that is, but what am I going to be when I arrive? And I believe I'll get there. And like we said earlier, there changes. Today, there is this. Tomorrow, there might be that. 19 years into marriage, it's that. That's there, you know? And that's the knowledge that age gives us when that 23-year-old was like, I'm ready.
As Taran says, it's important for us all to be ready for the changes and curveballs that can be thrown our way. COVID has certainly been case in point of that. And in this week's bonus episode, I take you behind the scenes with a conversation Taran and I had before the interview, talking about my own pivot during this pandemic, as well as the demise of First Wives Club. Now, bonus episodes like these are only available to supporters of Why I'll Never Make It. And a big thank you goes to Robin Kirkpatrick, who has been a consistent supporter of this podcast and just recently gave another donation. And I couldn't be more grateful for her support. So if you'd like to help this podcast as well, then please consider either a donation or an ongoing subscription by going to whyillnevermakeit.com or just click on the link in the show notes. And now back to Taran's third story, where he opens up about his son being diagnosed with autism at the age of 9. You say that this has changed your life and that it transformed your work. It opened you up to pain that you had tucked away, brought anxiety to surface that you had to confront head on. Now, what people may not realize is that autism isn't just one thing. There is a spectrum of autism, and it manifests itself differently for each person. So what exactly was he diagnosed with?
He has, it's called anticipatory anxiety and Asperger's. That's what they call it. They don't really use the term Asperger's anymore. And like you said, there is more of a spectrum, and he's high functioning, meaning he, you know, he goes to school, like he has friends, but there's some social things and there's some things that he does that has to soothe his anxiety or depression at times. And we didn't realize that, you know, Andrew didn't speak until he was 3 years old, which could be normal. You know what I mean? We sent him to a couple like ear therapist and stuff like that during school, but there was nothing blatant that said something was wrong, you know, until socially we could see his anxiety, you know, Socially, we could see that he didn't want to be on the playground without supervision because he needed to be told what to do. But in the class with structure, he was fine. And then we could see at nine, the buildup of the pressure that he could not communicate. He couldn't tell us what was wrong. That ultimately led to the diagnosis when we found out he was carrying this weight of, I don't know what's going on with me and I can't communicate and I don't know, but I can't carry it anymore.
So was it initially these psychological things that you thought maybe he just needs therapy or something? Or what led you to think, okay, we need to see a medical doctor about these issues?
Well, I mean, I'll give you as much as I can. There was just some indicators that were red flags for us that were to protect safety in him as a young child that we go, oh, okay, we need to listen to these things because he's not safe. He doesn't feel safe, you know? And we took those cues and investigated, and that's what we found.
So was there a sense of release?
Yeah, there was like, oh, okay, well, there's something there. Even though you don't want to pinpoint it all the time, you don't want to, we tell him it's more of a gift he has. We tell him that everybody, I feel like everybody's on some kind of spectrum. I really do.
I believe that too. We all have varying degrees of it. Yeah.
You know, and basically a lot of us not diagnosed because of the times of when we were younger and our parents didn't know what that was or, you know, whatever certain beliefs that is. So, you know, Andrew thinks differently. He processes differently, which is also makes him successful in the way that he needs to be. And we continue to encourage him in that way. But there were a lot of rocky moments. He's 14 now, and now he's able to communicate more and there's trust there more. But there was a long time where me and my wife, it was some hard, hard times for us. But what I say transformed me is the way that I had to be in the moment for him. The way that he expects the truth, because he can see, you know, as normal parents, you want to protect your child. So you might not always tell the truth, or you might say, oh, I'm fine or whatever. You can't do that in the case of a kid with autism because they feel, they know. So my point, Patrick, is I really had to show up. I had to show up for my life. I had to show up for my marriage. I had to show up for my career. I had to be real, true, and vulnerable. And I had to actually go to therapy for myself to find out some things that I had actually locked away that this event brought out. So I'm thinking, you know, I wouldn't wish this on anybody, but it's a blessing to have a child like Andrew to help me see myself and to help me see others. I'm more patient. I'm more tolerant. I can roll with the flow. I can try to stay more in the moment. I'm more authentic. And those are the gifts that I got from my son. But, you know, yeah, it's definitely a wrench that we weren't prepared for, because sometimes you find these things out earlier on when you have a child, you know, not all of a sudden at nine, you know.
So when he was diagnosed and you're starting to understand what his autism means and what needs to change, as you said, you started to adjust even how you spoke to him and related. So did you worry as much about how this would change your life as it would your son's?
Yeah, there was a lot of different worries about the attention that I would have to give him and what that attention would take away from my life, right? The energy, it's a lot of energy. So yeah, there was a concern. I have another daughter, she's 10. So there's a concern about her. There's a concern about the family dynamic. But in the voice thing that we talked about earlier with me losing my voice, I had a tool of understanding change and how things go and how things flow and the meaning of things. And I've always wanted to be a father. I've always wanted to be a husband. So again, my career and all that stuff was second, third, fourth, fifth on the list of things that I needed to really be concerned with, other than the provision part of it. And I knew since before I had so many other ways that I could provide if I couldn't do that one thing and really need to attend to him. I already had those tools. But most importantly, what it gained me, what I got from it was a time. It was almost like another pandemic. I had to shut down some things in order to address some things in my life that wasn't working, that I thought was working, an openness that I did not have, that I had to have to communicate to my son to get him to trust me. So the benefits outweighed, you know, some of the hard days. And we call it today, we call A days or B days. You know, are you having an A day or B day. Doesn't mean a good or bad day. Just like, where are we, right? And how many times in my life had I not assessed where I was because I wanted other people to feel good about themselves? So if they asked me how I was, I could never say I was not well because I had to be great, or because I knew eventually I would be well, I would just get there faster and be like, yeah, I'll be fine, I'm fine, when I really wasn't, you know? And so there's a lot that went into service of finding this out with Andrew, and now just seeing his resilience and his bravery and his courage, and it's just a beautiful experience, as hard as it is.
Yeah,
you know,
with those A and B days, as you call them, is it difficult at times to separate your son from the condition to direct any anger, frustration, whatever it is, at the autism rather than at him?
Ooh, that's a good question. The funny thing is I never, ever, well, I don't say ever, I don't do that a lot where I blame the condition. I can see my son separate from the condition. What I do see is myself. I see in my son the little boy that I was. And that's what I have to wrestle with when he's looking at me. If, I don't know. The circumstance as it is right now leads me to heal the little boy, the 9-year-old boy up to the 14-year-old boy through therapy. It's more of a door for that than it is a door for my own anxieties, let's say, for my own things that I have that were kind of tucked away. That unlocked a lot of that. So I see that more than I see him having a condition. I just see more like, wow, he's giving me an opportunity to heal myself. Mm.
What was one of those anxieties that you found yourself having to address and be healed from?
Well, I think, you know, I'll be candid. I think my dad, you know, had high expectations of me being someone that would reflect on him. Meaning, as parents, we have kids. And so we all think that if our kids act a certain way, then that reflects on us. You know what I mean? If they become this, then we, right, right. And I love my dad. He's one of my best friends. But I think there's a flaw into that. I don't expect that from my son. I don't expect my son to define who I am based on his choices and based on who he is. I actually want him to be exactly who he wants to be, can be in this world. I want to help him in that, but I'm not giving him the pressure of that. And so the anxiety for me was I always knew I had a voice that was shut down, so to speak, so the voice of my father could be heard, or whatever he needed at that time, or whatever would fulfill him. And so the chance for me to do that over and say, yeah, even though I'm scared and I want my children to flourish and I can see some of the danger signs and I want to stop them, we try to have a home of freedom. So they could find their way and we can hear them. So Andrew, being able to hear him, have him communicate, have him say he's sad, he's confused, he's angry, he's those things that I could never say, you know, is the healing process for all of us. And I really needed to, even though that was tucked away, and I believe if it wasn't for Andrew, there would still probably be a part of me that would be locked away, because I don't know if there was another way I would be able to confront it, just to be honest.
Because it sounds like that through Andrew, you're able to see yourself reflected back, and in both good and bad ways, in both frustrating ways and things that probably that tear you up inside. And through that, you're able to, as you said, address these things that were from your own childhood that you had tucked away, locked away, but were now able to express and open up. And that through that, that's how Andrew has now been able to express and unlock himself. Once you were able to be there, then he could be there as well.
Patrick, that's it, man. That's it. And the fact that I could also see my father, because we can always say, oh, we want to change what our parents did and we're going to be completely different. Good luck. there's still a part of you that it's in you. It's in you. And so I find myself, am I going to react like I had been shown Of course I will. That's the natural reaction, you know? And even to confound that with this diagnosis, there were times where I was like, you know, I'm my father, you know? But to be able to make another choice, to find something that could heal the whole situation, and I'm not 100% there, is the greatest gift for me. And to also have the empathy for my father and what he was going through at the time to be a dad, and the pressures and the weights that he had as a person, because I have them too, you know? So, you know, there's no, just like the spectrum of, you know, his autism, there's a spectrum of emotions. And I think sometimes we do, it's this or this. It can be and. Sometimes it's and. I'm this and that and that. And it can be complicated. Allowing myself to not judge those things and make that holy mess, accept it, accept the holy mess, and that it doesn't have to be a reflection of who I am and what I'm doing. I'm doing the best that I can, was the freedom that this whole process has taught me, which in turn goes into my performing work and my work that I do as a job.
So in what ways, as you've grown and kind of found out more about yourself, in what ways have you found yourself being able to help Andrew more than you could have before?
I think in those authentic ways of our conversations are more me revealing about myself and saying, I'm scared too. I'm worried too. I'm disappointed, whatever those things that I would want to hide or control or present in another way, it has opened me up to be able to help him feel like it's okay, that there's nothing wrong with what he's feeling, maybe on different levels, but to say, oh, no, it's not that you have this thing and we have this thing. We all are having these things that we work out, and how we adjust to them and how we overcome them might be different. But I think he's just getting a more vulnerable friend, more vulnerable father, and more of an example. I want to be an example to him of how he can overcome, because I'm doing it myself. So that's just been the gift, I think, for all of us. And, you know, to also, because he's high functioning, there's days where we forget Patrick. There's like completely days. And then the next day, if it's a B day, we're like, oh. So that's the other challenging thing, which I don't wish it on anybody. But I think for a parent that has to deal with something every single day, they may know that it's coming. They have a different piece of the spectrum. For us, some days I'm like, oh, he's just Andrew, you know, and trying to balance, is that adolescence? Now he's, you know, he's 14. So is that hormonal? Is that this? Is that Andrew's personality? Is that autism? That's tricky to define what those things are. But I think that's the problem. We're so quick to fix and diagnose and point and label that we're not able to understand, you know, how we move and flow through the world. And I get to see that every day in a different way.
How has the autism affected your wife as well as your daughter?
Wow. Well, I can't speak for them. I know for my wife, my mother is different. It's just different when you are birth a child, even with my perspective as the parent. I mean, we're co-parenting, but there's some heartbreaking things that I cannot take on that she's experienced as a mother, you know? So many, many dark days for her. But I'm happy to say that our marriage has been stronger because we have chosen. We knew that we needed to, even that we had to go to therapy together. We went to therapy, Patrick, for our son. And the therapist said, oh, he's fine, but you guys stay, you know? And her point was that he's fine. You guys need help to parent him, to understand, to move beyond what that is. And she was absolutely right, you know? So we had a series of time with that just focused on our marriage and how we felt and what we were reflecting. So, you know, I'm sitting here today in a grateful space. Our marriage is very, very strong. It showed us our resilience and our commitment to each other. Because a lot of people didn't understand. A lot of other family and friends, maybe to this day, still don't understand, because they see Andrew and go, oh, what are you guys talking about? And I'm like, so there's a lot of that loneliness that we've had to forge together. My daughter's 10 going on 40. So she's very smart. and gracious and understanding. And it has been difficult. And we make sure that we attend to her needs and that she understands what's going on, but she also understands that she can talk to us and that she doesn't feel the weight of it. But I will say, Patrick, you do the best you can. I'm not sure we're doing everything perfect. I'm not sure we're doing everything right. I hope, try to be attentive to that, but I've had to release that because that gets me to another worry place that, am I saying everything right? Did I cross every T? That maybe I did, maybe I don't. We have a thing in our home where we say love is the final word. Maybe we didn't do all that right. Maybe you missed school. Maybe you didn't get that. But love, we will make sure that that's the final thing that we build everything on and hope for the best for the rest of the stuff, because I feel like that's the most important thing we need to get to.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that in all of our stories that we've talked about, that basis of love and that foundation of being true to ourselves and releasing expectation, releasing our fear and anxiety of what could change, of what could be different, of what could not be what we want, but releasing that and being like, but am I in a place where I can accept that change, where I can be ready for that next rug to be pulled out or for that next award to come my way, whatever it is, that we're ready for it.
Yeah. And the big word that comes to me is grace, you know, giving, we're big on giving others grace and we're not big on giving ourselves this the same, you know, and we deserve it. We deserve it. Even if you are a good person and you believe well for others, it's time to turn that spotlight back on yourself because we deserve that grace, you know, for ourselves. Hard thing to do sometimes, but it's important. And it doesn't mean that you're selfish.
Yeah. It just means we're human and we're trying to get to the next day the best we can.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Taran, this has been, it's been such a joy to reconnect and these beautiful stories that you've shared with us. So I greatly appreciate you coming on and opening up like this.
Yeah, thank you for the platform and the heart that's open to hearing these stories. We all have them, you know, we all have them. And I just want to say, I think the best is yet to come. That's really what keeps me, that's the underlying fire in me, is I have this crazy hope that, you know, I'm 47 years old, whatever, the book is, I'm old, but I do believe that the best is yet to come and I'm excited for that. So that keeps me going.
Thank you so much for joining Taran and myself today. But remember, the conversation continues with the final five questions on the Win Me blog. And also be sure to check out his podcast, Honest Answers with Taran Brooks. You'll find links to that podcast as well as the final five questions in the show notes or by going to whyillnevermakeit.com. Well, I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, in charge of writing, editing, and producing this podcast. Background music is by Blue Dot Sessions. Why I'll Never Make It is a part of the Helium Radio Network and a member of the Broadway Makers Alliance. Join me next time as we talk more about Why I'll Never Make It.